It's Friday, May 2nd, 2003, 10:04 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. It's time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind, the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or its board, the Pataphysical Broadcasting Foundation. This morning on Geek Speak, we are taking your calls with questions about your computer or technology in general. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Before we take your calls, we're going to invite the geeks to come in and talk about the news. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air room, Miles Elam, John Tracy, Dee Dee Hubbard. Welcome, geeks, to Geek Speak.
Thank you, Lyle.
Morning, Lyle.
Hey. What is up with the news today? Let's start actually on the Microsoft Server 2003, Miles.
Apparently, Windows 2003 Server, which hasn't been released yet, you know, still in beta, has some software compatibility issues. Now, Microsoft has actually stated that that's what they were expecting. They were dropping some backward compatibility in exchange for basically trying to write a piece of software that, or an operating system that they could concentrate on making it more secure, faster, just without having to worry about any old craft. But that basically means that only about 60 to 70% of, NT software is going to work on it.
Now, NT is pretty old.
Right. It depends. I mean, since 2000, so 3 years. I guess in software terms it would be, but or at least that's when 2000 came
out. So do they have examples of some of the software that's not going to work on Server 2003?
Well, that's what they're talking about with NT. However, what people are finding is that even the newer software, the stuff that's only about a year or two old, isn't working. Like SQL Server 2000 requires a patch to work, and any previous version of SQL Server won't work. Exchange 2000 and 5.5 doesn't work at all, so your mail servers are going to be hurting for a while. BizTalk Server 2002, SharePoint Portal Server 2001, Content Manager 2000, Mobile Information Server 2002. These are all pieces of software that won't work.
Now, these are some actually kind of new software.
Yeah. Mobile Information Server isn't all that expensive. I think that's one of the justifications for that. But BizTalk Server is very expensive.
Well, how much is Microsoft, this new server operating system, Microsoft Server 2003, going to be?
Apparently, the standard edition is going to be $7,000 per CPU.
Isn't that a little excessive for server software?
Their enterprise software is actually pretty up there. I mean, when you have a company that requires a really high end operating system. Something that can handle server farms, for example, and a lot of failover clustering, you're going to get very expensive.
Well, but it's $7,000 per CPU.
Yeah.
Not so per install.
Right. So if you have a dual CPU system, you're paying twice that. But
now, this is interesting. I've always kind of, I mean, if you want a good, reliable, fast server, you kind of go with a Sun station, a Sun server, right?
It depends.
But Microsoft's theory for a long time on servers even was get a lot of machines and have them sharing the load, and one fails and no big deal because you got more. And that's kind of been the concept. At least that was my understanding. That's how I've implemented it in the past. So this would kind of change that paradigm because that's enough money where it starts becoming an issue.
It may start eating into the hardware costs. At the same time, well, yeah, it is a more considerable portion of the whole server cost than it used to be. It used to be the hardware was much more expensive, and now the hardware is becoming cheaper, and the software is becoming more expensive. But, or at least it's going back to where it used to be. To be the software was very expensive, too.
All right. Next on the item, you have anything more on that?
Also, when I was talking about SQL Server 2000 requires a patch,
SQL Server 2000, that's a pretty big database server. I mean, that's a common install In fact, recently we had a virus that affected that, and it affected a lot of machines, affected the entire internet. So it's broadly distributed.
Right.
It's being used a lot, but right. It requires a patch.
Right. And one of the hopes was that they would get SQL Server 2003 out, so that would work with it. And unfortunately, SQL Server 2003 has issues on Windows 2003 Server. So that's a give and take.
Wow. Okay, well, thank you for keeping us up to date on what Microsoft's doing next. Do we have any idea of when that's going to be released?
Sometime in 2003.
It being May, let's hope they get on it soon. Again, that's Microsoft Server 2003 in beta right now, and basically rumors that Miles has, but quite interesting. Dee Dee?
I heard that they were going to try to push it out in sometime in summer, even though some of the modules weren't quite ready.
Interesting. So they're kind of...
Wait for that first service back, apparently.
I guess so. Let's talk about Apple. What's Apple doing?
Music. Do you want to
start it off?
No, why don't you take the first one?
I'll start it off. So,
No.
Macintosh on their last... they've been pushing the iLife, and that's the suite of applications that start with an I. iTunes, iMovie, iDVD.
iPhoto.
And these are all things to deal with your digital media on your Macintosh computer.
It's part of their digital hub concept.
Right. Now, they just released we're talking like 3 days ago, a new music service called, it's iTunes 4. It's a newer version of iTunes, which is a music player. And now they have a service that allows you to buy songs.
iTunes Music Store.
Okay. And Dee Dee, you bought some songs yesterday.
I bought a couple of Massive Attack exclusives, which supposedly you can't find anywhere else on the iTunes Music Store. Downloaded them, proceeded to listen to them, and get really kind of hooked on the idea of paying for clean and rare and also just music that I could, you know, it's one click away and then it's in my library and I can put it on my iPod. I can make unlimited CD burns and I can share it with up to 3 other Macs that I use.
You make unlimited CD burns?
Unlimited CD burns, as long as you change your playlist every 10 burns.
Right.
It's so that you can't mass duplicate the CD and pirate it out that way.
Interesting. Because, of course, once you have a CD, you can dupe it as many times as you want.
Right.
So the general concept here is that they've got a giant library store. They have prices for each of the songs on the library. And
99 cents per song.
Okay, and all of them are like that?
All of the songs are 99 cents. Some albums are actually at reduced prices.
Now,
are you
surfaced in this whole interface who the producer of the song was, what record company actually did that? Do you see that?
You do have the artist, you do have the producer. I don't know if you have the company. You can also download the cover art.
Yeah, I noticed that too, which is an interesting interface. Pretty much any song that you've downloaded, you can then look at and see the cover art if they have it in their library.
And you can add your own art if you wanted to make it cover art. iTunes now has a little section where you can... raise the cover art on and check out the selected songs, so you can drag pictures that you associate with the music also.
So what about free music? Do they have any free music up there at all?
You can go online and check out 30-second previews, but that's about as free as it gets.
Okay. So the question I had about producers and record companies being involved in this is that Apple, of course, has to have a relationship with
Warner,
distributors.
BMG, EMI, Sony Music, and Universal.
They've got the big five.
Okay. They've got a lot of the music then. So how many songs are we talking about here in this library?
Currently they have 275,000 is songs? The current and growing.
That's pretty big. Miles, what are your thoughts on this? You seem kind of quiet.
I don't know. Better than buying a CD. Buying a whole CD when all you want is a song or two.
In fact, the music on this system is encoded at a higher quality than the CD.
Right. It's in the AAC format, which is MPEG-4. So it's a next generation MPEG format. It's at 128 kilobytes per second, which you're probably thinking right now that that's comparable to 128 kilobytes per second in MP3.
Kilobit.
But it's actually a little bit higher quality because of the different various encodings. And also, the new file format produces smaller file sizes per song. So you can fit more of them on your iPod if you had one.
And it does have good features to iPod, which is, of course, Macintosh's MP3, portable MP3 player.
Right, which segues into the next news item.
Which is the brand new iPod.
They have three new iPods.
They're
and, uh,
Go ahead.
We have two Mac geeks in the house, and they both want to talk about
it. No, it's my news.
John, why don't you go ahead and cover it?
All right. They have three new ones, ranging from 10 gigabyte, 15 gigabyte, and 30 gigabytes of storage. And when you say storage, you can store music or files. For a while, I had my iPod as a bootable OS X drive for troubleshooting, but I ran out of space for that. Had to kick that off for
music.
On
there,
right.
Uh-huh.
It's about half the weight and half the thickness of the old one. Comes with a little recharging cradle. So before, where you'd plug in the FireWire cable, that would recharge and download. Now it has a little dock that you set it on that does all that. It's got some cool new features, like you can do, you can make playlists on the fly. So while you have your iPod and you want to make a playlist, you can do that. You can put scripts in it, so it can do different things for you. Read text. Comes with a couple of games now.
Now, it's not really a full-featured calendar or
no.
of that nature.
No, it does work with iCal, which is another one of Apple's iLife, which can keep track of calendar stuff and contact information. So you have
contact
that.
Contact information, too.
Yeah.
So your address book's there.
Right. So you have that information available, but you can't input anything. You can't make changes. You can't schedule appointments. So it's not quite yet the perfect all-in-one device.
Does it have an alarm for the calendar?
It has an alarm.
I don't know.
Okay, good, good. Didi, do you want to hit anything else on that? Like,
they also added a USB 2.0.
Which is a faster USB standard, USB being universal serial bus.
Targeted toward the Windows customers.
Right.
And you'll have Mac and Windows software in the same box, so you can't get confused on whether it's a Mac iPod or if it's a Windows iPod. And the iTunes Music Store should be... They're actually hiring a software engineer lead for porting iTunes over to Windows.
So
by the end of the year.
So okay, so this service that Apple doesn't want to just offer it to Mac users, they want to offer it to everybody. I wonder if they're going to do a Linux port as well. And I also wonder if they're going to charge a different rate for PC downloads. That'd be interesting. I'm sure they won't, but I would if I were them. Anything else on the subject?
Right now, you can download iTunes 4 for your Mac, but there's no Windows version.
And it's free. The
iTunes 4
player
is free.
Mm-hmm. And it's a good player. It plays a lot of things. It actually uses QuickTime for its playing.
There has been some reports about the sound quality isn't as good with iTunes 4.
Interesting.
Some people think it's because they're trying to play with the dynamic range that it produces sound in. So it's actually lowered it from 6 to 9 decibels.
Interesting. What do you mean sound in?
Sorry?
They're trying to produce sound in, you said?
No, they're trying to do a more dynamic range, not sound in.
Okay, more
if
dynamic
I said
range.
That,
okay, I understand. Sorry. More news?
Apparently the...
Did you have more on the subject? Go ahead.
There's more. Apple is throwing a party to celebrate the new iTunes Music Store, so if you are around an Apple store tonight... Between 6 and 10 p.m., you can enjoy a live DJ spinning on his iPod.
Now, this is a pretty common thing now for musicians to be using
a laptop or
an iPod.
Yeah.
And mixing music. You're seeing it more and more. Are you going, Didi, to any Apple stores?
Where is our nearest Apple store?
There's one in Santa Clara, and there's another one at Valley Fair. Sorry, there's one in Palo Alto, and there's one in Valley Fair in Santa Clara.
Relatively close.
You could also, there's a chance to win a limited edition JBL sound system worth about $1,800. You can get a free event poster and a limited edition t-shirt for $10, or free if you buy an iPod.
Great. Any other news, Miles?
The land speed record after 20 years has been broken.
In your Prius?
Meaning basically on a rolling vehicle.
Well, it's a rail-based.
Rail, okay.
A monorail. But... It was rocket-powered, went Mach 8.6.
So 8.6 times faster than the speed of sound.
Right. 6,400 miles an hour.
What's that in kilometers?
10,298 kilometers per hour.
Sounds so much more impressive in kilometers.
Yeah. the last 1.8 miles, the last 2.89 kilometers were done in 1.3 seconds.
Whew. That's fast.
Yeah, and the whole thing was 3 miles or 5 kilometers. It was done in 6 seconds total.
Wow.
Now, to put this in perspective, if you're on the highway, you're going to be going about a mile every minute.
So, and this was how many in a second?
And this was about a mile every 2 seconds.
Wow. The person that was in this vehicle, I'm assuming this was a... Oh, no one was in it? Does anyone know if it was in it?
It was a 192-pound dummy payload. They called it a missile. This is your tax dollars hard at work here. The U.S. government put this on.
Really? Wow. So we didn't have a person on it.
No.
Well, that's depressing.
And the article...
The G's would be a little hard for a human to take anyway. So
the article I read was that at the end, they released the missile so it could hit its target. I was thinking, this is a very strange missile delivery system.
Monorail delivery.
Right. Wait till the target.
Ignore the
monorail,
please. here's a little news quiz for the geeks in the house. What's 10 years old this week?
Mosaic.
Very good. And therefore, the World Wide Web.
No, there were browsers before Mosaic. Mosaic was simply the most popular and the one that made...
And had inline images.
Had inline images. Okay, the visual web? Do you agree?
Okay.
Mosaic basically launched the web, the first web browser. Prior to that, of course, the internet, it was around for a long time. There was multiple applications, but the Mozilla web browser web browser definitely launched what we know of as the World Wide Web now. And its growth rate was exponential, and it's finally not exponential, I don't think.
Actually,
hardware's not built fast enough now.
According to our news last week, it's leveling off.
And some people have stopped using it.
Yeah, a lot of people are, I used to do the web. I don't do that anymore.
So 10 years now, you can have a machine doing the World Wide Web. News, other news?
In gaming news, the Half-Life mod Day of Defeat, which is a World War II-based mod, has been released and will be available as a separate purchase on May 6th.
Half-Life, a first-person shooter game.
Very fine.
You like it?
Yes.
You looking forward to this game?
Yeah, actually.
And we're done with the news?
Well, if you want me to, I could...
Well, hang on just a second. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxel. We are taking your calls or emails with questions or comments about computer or technology in general. We can handle Mac, Linux, and even some Windows questions and much more. We have four ways of contacting us. In the 831 area code, 476-2800. Toll-free from California, 1-800-655-5877. Toll-free from the other 49 U.S. states at 1-800-659-5877. Or from anywhere in the planet or near orbit at geeks@geekspeak.org. Again, that's geeks@geekspeak.org. We'll take your calls, questions, emails about your computer, about any technology.
Just the last one was... two individuals, Alan Murphy and Adam Brower. They are associated with spamhouse.org and Spews, respectively. These are both anti-spam organizations. Basically, they set up blacklists. They basically say, these certain hosts, these IP addresses, have a bunch of spam coming from them. We're going to compile a list of all of these and then give it out to different ISPs and the like all around the world and say, this is where spam comes from, block these IP numbers so people don't send spam from there or send mail from there. It's all or nothing. You either send all mail or no mail. And they've been served with a suit by eMarketers America. The thing with eMarketers America is that they haven't actually said who they represent.
But basically they're spammers.
Well, they cite that the people that they represent aren't necessarily spammers, that they're legitimate business people. But then again, it's kind of shady either way.
So they brought a lawsuit. This group of undefined companies has brought a lawsuit against these two individuals.
Yeah,
okay.
Activists,
kind of. But also that, are they making a profit on
not to my knowledge. To put it into perspective, when we talk about blacklists, when we talk about blocking an IP range or a certain host, by doing that, think of all the spam that you get in your mailbox. I'm sure a bunch of people, you know, even if you have filters, you'll get two or three that come through or whatnot. Bear in mind that blacklists stop at or more 90% of spam that's out there, because most of the spam comes from these open relays. The open relays are what's being blocked. So very mixed feelings about something that's, that's suing people who are trying to keep these lists up to date and perform the service.
You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxel. We invite your questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, and you can geek email us geeks@geekspeak.org. Any more news? All right, so we're waiting for calls at this point. You want to call and ask questions about your computers, technology? We can take your calls, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can also email us, geeks@geekspeak.org.
Well, if there aren't
please,
any calls,
Miles, do.
Like, pull in some stuff I wasn't going to mention before. There's a ongoing legal battle going on between SCO and IBM at this point. SCO was purchased by Caldera Systems, a Linux distributor, a few years back. And
SCO stands for?
Santa Cruz Operation. And they actually owned the Unix trademark. And there was a whole battle going on. Basically, Caldera SCO, actually called SCO now, I believe they're changing their name, were in financial difficulty, and they have filed a major set of lawsuits, like against a dozen companies, saying that code, proprietary code and intellectual property from the original AT&T Unix code has been appropriated by licensees for use in the Linux operating system. In other words, they've stolen the code. Most people have regarded this as being spurious at best, and IBM has replied to these accusations saying that they're completely false, and calls into question SCO's motives for doing this, basically saying that, you know, they can't compete, so now they're just trying to sue people out of existence as a, you know, as a revenue source.
And is how far have the lawsuits gone?
It's very early stages at this point.
Okay, but it's kind of the news is actually not whether they've won or anything. The news is that they're actually trying to do this.
IBM has actually replied. This is actually
what's
that
IBM's response?
Basically, that the this case has no merit. They haven't done anything illegal. They haven't taken any code from the AT&T code base, original AT&T code base. That any things they've done have been their own code or code from outside Linux is just code from outside developers.
Jewel from Santa Cruz, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I wonder, you were talking about spam, and I wondered if you've tried Curb. It's a quick spam kind of program, and it just got editor's choice in PC Magazine. It's really good. I have it on my computer.
What does it do?
It blocks spam. It really does work. You have a chance. They put things in quarantine. You have a chance to choose your approved senders, so like it goes through your into your Outlook. I mean, I use it with Microsoft Outlook, and it goes in and checks your whole box, all your contacts, and comes up with a list that you then approve. You know, this is
of people that can send you mail, no matter what it is. Uh huh.
They call it a whitelist. I wasn't aware of that till I read this article, but anyway. There's a whole bunch of good spam fighters out there, and this is a good one.
And hopefully they won't get sued by companies that are trying to spam. Well, Jewel, thank you for the recommendation of Curb. I'm assuming you can find that by going to Google and typing C-R-U-B.
No.
K-E-R-B.
K-U-U-R-B.
Q-U-U-R-B. Oh, because there's another spam program called K-E-R-B, Curb.
Well, this is Q-U-R-B.
Well, Jewel, thank you very much for the call.
Sure.
So there are a lot of utilities out there, in fact, that do this kind of thing where people can either buy the service. Some of them are actually free. There's and then there's also
on the server we're using Spam Assassin to try to catch all the spam on server side before it even hits our inbox.
Bill from Santa Cruz, another spam question. Hi, Bill. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Thanks. You guys are just really a treat all the time. This is a really quick question on the spam. I'm using Adora, and I'm pretty good at using the filters to strip stuff out. I've been getting one particularly annoying series of spam in which the from line is simply the word some bozo. But when I strip out all the stuff and look for some bozo to isolate it, I can't find it. Is that something that the program just makes up because there is no from? Technically, am I making myself at all clear?
Yeah, probably what's happening is it's doing a MIME encoding or some type of outside encoding on it. Sometimes the equivalent would be on web pages where there's a character on the screen where you can't type it in the keyboard. You have to put in a character code for it. So
it just generates it up there.
Right.
How do you isolate for that then?
It's fairly difficult.
Eudora's filtering might actually support it. If you'd like to redirect, use Eudora's redirect. You know how to do that?
Right.
Use Eudora's redirect and send that spam to Lyle at geekspeak.org. I'll take a look at the headers and see if I can figure it out. But probably, as Miles says, it's in the MIME, a different MIME block, and it's going to be a little hard to...
Well, I mean, it's going to be MIME encoded. It's going to be a different coding. So it depends upon the mailer as well as to whether or not...
Guys, I'm in the car, so I'm gonna go off and just listen to the rest of this.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much, Bill. I cut him off a little too soon, but yeah, so what? Explain that again, Miles.
Well, it's basically, say for example, I want to put in a, I'm Spanish and I want to, or Hispanic, and I want to put in an E with an accent on it, with an acute accent on it. And that character isn't on the keyboard. You know, some people have internationalized keyboards and the like, but what happens if you want to be able to, you know, to put this into a program? What happens if you don't? If your keyboard isn't set up to have that type of thing, that type of character? This happens a lot in Unicode, where you have other languages, especially Asian languages and Arabic, Greek, and the like. And so you have to put in a character code. Each character has its own code. In the case of the English language or the romanized alphabet, you have the letter B is ASCII code 66. You know, for example.
Okay.
And so each letter...
But when he's explaining this name of this person, it's not any strange characters. It's...
Except that to get these special characters, you have to put in a special code. Or you have to put in the code explicitly, whether it be, you know, code 107 or whatnot.
Okay, so it could be...
But you could also put in 66 and get out a capital B.
Okay. So it's possible that the spam message is using a different type of character set, and then is encoding all of those letters in that character set. It has to if it's defining the character set. And in there is that subject line or that from line.
So basically the email program is reading in that character code and spitting out the letter so you see the letters, but the spam but the mail filter is doing an exact match. And the exact match won't may just be finding a, you know, 107, 106, 105.
The people who send spam actually go to these lengths to defeat filters?
Absolutely.
Wow.
There have been quite a few spams that have come out recently that are made specifically to defeat spam filters. That they find out exactly what it catches. This is something we found on the GeekSpeak server as well, that ones that they misspell a naughty word, for example, or play around with the wording.
Most of these spam utilities are available to anybody, and if they're not available to anybody, they're available to people that can buy them. So there's a whole industry now for getting spam detection software, installing it, and then offering a service to spammers that say, send me the message and I'll tell you why it's failing, and you can then fix your spam so that it will not get caught by spam filters.
Tech support for spammers are great.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks Dee Dee, Miles, and John. We invite your questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can email us at geeks@geekspeak.org. This program is supported by a grant from Cruzio, providing internet services including DSL and spam filters for home and office throughout Santa Cruz County. Information about Cruzio membership is available online at cruzio.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. You are listening to GeekSpeak. In the air room with me, John Tracy, Miles Elam, Dee Dee Hubbard. We await your questions and comments.
This is John Tracy bringing you this week's GeekBit. Power and protection. Did you know one of the most common causes of computer problems is unclean power? Think about it. A computer is comprised of billions of switches and transistors, each one needing power to jump from 0 to 1. If just one of these does not get the power it needs or gets too much power, it can cause freezes, crashes, corrupted data, or even damaged hardware. So what can you do? The simplest and cheapest solution is a good surge protector. Make sure you get one that's rated higher than 1,250 joules. That's the minimum you need to protect your computer. Look on the box to see what the rating is. If there is no joule rating, that surge protector is probably not going to serve your need. Most office supply stores carry surge protectors that are more than adequate. Also, make sure the surge protector has a shiny UL sticker on it. UL stands for Underwriter Laboratories, and they test different devices to make sure they live up to their advertised ratings. What else can you do? The best way to protect your computer, especially in winter, is to purchase an uninterruptible power supply, or UPS. These devices have a battery as well as a surge protector. If the power goes out or browns out, which is when the power goes below 110 volts, the battery will supply your computer with power long enough for you to save your work and shut the computer down. All right, you're saying, I've looked at UPSs, but there are dozens to choose from. How do I know which is the right one? Well, you're in luck. In the past, you needed to know the consumption in watts of all the equipment you were going to hook up to the UPS. You had to add them together, and that would give you a number that equated to consumption in watts. You would then look for a UPS that had that number or higher. Now, most UPS boxes have a chart on the side showing you several different system and monitor choices, and how long each would run with that UPS. Also, you can visit websites of different UPS manufacturers. Most of them have tools that will help you figure out what size UPS you need. Two notes for your new UPS. One, it will come with the battery unplugged and uncharged. You will need to open it up and hook up a wire before you can use it. And two, never, never plug a laser printer into a UPS. Laser printers draw way too much current for a UPS to handle. Inkjet printers are fine, however. This has been John Tracy with your Geek Bit. Tune in Friday mornings for Geek Speak here on listener-supported Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
And you are listening to Central Coast Public Radio, Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. We're taking your calls about computer or any technology questions or comments. The phone number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can email, like Tom did, to geeks@geekspeak.org. Tom just sent us an email about a quote from spamhouse.org. I'm assuming that's spamhouse.org. The attorney for emarkersamerica.org, which basically recently produced the lawsuit against two anti-spam activists, Mark E. Feinstein, he's the attorney, is also the sole proprietor of emarketersamerica.org, which is registered to Mark Feinstein. By no coincidence, Mark E. Feinstein is also the personal lawyer of America's top spammer, Eddie Marin. So, basically, people are figuring out who this lawyer is, who the organization is. You can find more information about this. That quote is from spamhouse.org or spamhaus, A-H, without the E.
Spamhouse.
It is spamhouse. Okay, just a typo in the email.
No, that's what the URL is, but it's pronounced spamhouse.
Okay, spamhaus.org.
Great. Thank you, Tom, for that email. You can email us with questions or comments. geeks@geekspeak.org. We'll try to answer them on the air. A regular caller to GeekSpeak, or semi-regular caller to GeekSpeak, Pure Heart from Watsonville, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yeah, hi. I have a Linux question today.
Go ahead.
Yes, you're on.
I can't hear you. Okay, there you are. Hi. I'm using Dead Hat 6.2 right now, and when I'm using the Pine application to read mail, when I'm printing something, I use it LPR, but it reports, detected RQ7, use the proc file system to enable interrupt-driven operation. But it doesn't give any suggestions on how to do that. And you know, I kind of poked around at using, looking for man pages and looking in the proc file systems to the information there. But what do you change?
First off, did you call it Dead Hat just as a euphemism for
Red
Hat?
That's a joke.
Okay. Just making sure that it's, because there are a lot of distributions out there that have similar names. That's really odd to me, considering this is a fairly stock system, like you haven't...
Yeah, it's stock filters and everything. No other applications report this. This is just Pine's little idiosyncrasy. You know, you can just use LPR as is or put it through and, you know, any filters you want in script and things.
Older version of Pine?
Well, no, I mean, this is... okay, you have me stumped, because Red Hat 6.2 should be able to print out of the box that Pine...
It does fine. It's just an advisory thing that says...
Oh, it prints fine.
Yeah, it prints fine, but it says it detected RQ7, use the proc file system to enable interrupter-driven operation. I was kind of curious, you know. That's great. I'd like to try it.
The only thing I can think of would be going to University of Washington to Pine's homepage.
Okay.
And finding out information about that. Because that
idea
sounds very much like a Pine-specific item.
Okay.
It may or may not be true for different versions of Pine. It may be that there's a newer version of Pine that doesn't have that. It may be that it may speed up printing.
Yeah, I would agree. It's probably a Pine issue.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Well, good luck. Thanks for calling.
It works fine, though.
Great.
So you like Linux?
I like Linux, yeah.
Great.
Of course, I still miss CPM. I'd be happy with CPM and WordStar and all that kind of stuff. So I like Linux.
Well, thank you very much for the call.
Okay, bye.
Control KDE.
There's advantages and disadvantages to interrupt-driven printing.
Michael from Carmel, welcome to GeekSpeak.
How you doing?
Quite well. What's your question today?
Good. Just a general NTFS question. Indexing, on or off?
What do you do?
What do I do?
Yeah.
This is just I'm just trying to make the machine as efficient as possible.
It depends on what you do.
A lot of music stuff, a lot of music production, basically a little bit of video.
Okay, let's define what NTFS indexing is, Miles.
If memory serves, indexing was taking file attributes and putting them into a search index for quick access later on. So if you're not doing a whole bunch of searching, then if you're doing a whole bunch of searching, indexing will make the item come up faster. But it makes updates to the file system slower. If you have a heavy read-write activity, you don't necessarily want to have indexing on because it'll slow the I/O output. But if you have you're just doing a whole bunch of lookups on the file system, a whole bunch of lookup file names and file attributes, then it can help.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. I'm just always basically just trying to decrease the overhead if I can. So yeah, if I could, just ask you if you've got any more tips, I'll take my answer off the air.
What kind of operating system are you running?
XP.
Okay.
And XP on one machine, 2000 on another machine.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call.
Thanks.
Do we have any other suggestions for him?
If I'm wrong about that, I would love to hear about it, but that's mostly the case. That's the case in general for indexing in any section of software design.
Any other tips for making XP run faster?
Turn off system restore.
Turn off system restore?
System restore keeps making little backup points along the way, which takes away resources from what you may be currently doing.
So turn off system restore and hope.
But then
you
can't
don't
go back up to a certain restore point afterwards.
That's true.
So. More RAM. The more RAM you have, the faster it's going to go.
Robin from Templeton, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Well, good. About spam filters. Is there any one of them that actually rejects the mail and sends it back to the sender rather than just throwing it away?
Apple's built-in mail client has a feature called Bounce Back to Sender, which basically does that. It sends it back, and it's as though you were not a user on the system that they sent to.
Yeah, that would be the ideal, I would think, the ideal thing to do with spam.
The problem is the spammers don't care if they get bounced mail, because
the idea is to try and clog their end with
bounced
messages.
But the thing is, respond email addresses.
Usually what you're doing is clogging some poor high school's internet server.
Well, the thing is that if you do actually bounce the mail back, by the time you've gone to check your mail and actually download the message and then realize it's spam and then bounce it back to the server, if that address is valid at all, they know that, one, your address is valid because it's taken so long for the bounce message to come back, because most bounce messages would come back right away. So,
I guess you want to bounce it right away.
Which means that it would have to be on the server side. So.
Well, not really, because you can't rely upon the internet being timed-based. So as long as you do it within a day, that's technically legal for the server to say it. But yeah, I know what you're saying. I don't think anyone's being that smart in spam. The question really comes down to whether that message being bounced will actually cause the spam company to do anything, right? And the thing is, it doesn't really cost them much to keep people on lists. It doesn't. There is a trend to offer cleaner lists. So when you're selling lists to people, there's a whole industry for selling spam lists. When you do that, if you say, well, these are verified email addresses, or you get more money for them, but I do bounce. I sometimes bounce messages using a mail feature. There are mail. There. You can pretty much any spam server side spam thing like Spam Assassin. You can set up to bounce, It's just typically not done. And I would read maybe on like Spamhouse without the .org why you'd want to and why you wouldn't want to bounce messages back.
All right.
Well, any other questions, Roman?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. You're listening to Geek Speak in the house. Miles, Dee Dee, John. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is KUSP. Russell from Aptos, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Hi.
My question was basically about server-side scripting languages. I'm basically trying to develop a database-driven website for my boss, and I'm having a hard time choosing a language like JSP, ASP, PHP. Naturally, I'm drawn to PHP and MySQL just because, you know, they're free. And I come from kind of a Linux background, but unfortunately her host is using Windows 2000. So, and I don't really like ASP, but I just wanted to get your input because I don't really know enough about it to make an educated decision.
Well, Russell, you called the right group. All of us have opinions on this.
Miles is twitching.
Miles, you want to summarize what your... Well, okay, different server-side scripting languages. Yeah, you mentioned JSP, PHP, ASP. There's, of course, like a CGI alternative, and then there's other things. PHP has a wonderful development community. A lot of people are doing it. Miles, being a pure programmer at heart, would say that PHP is designed horribly, horribly wrong.
Oh, let Miles say it.
Yeah, let's do that, Miles. Why don't you say it?
There are people who use PHP, and they love it, and I don't hang out with those people. PHP has a very uneven API. If you learn one part of it, if you learn one part of it, it doesn't give you any insight into the rest of it. It's very haphazard.
For example, there are functions in PHP's API that says like SQL or MySQL underscore connection. Okay, or get connect. I'm not sure what the actual term is. So that function that you might get familiar with that database, MySQL, it's a completely different function if you wanted to talk to another database. Most systems that are designed well, you have a database object kind of thing that you connect with, and the functionality, the concepts behind it are always the same. If you have a database connection, you have a database connection. So there's a lot of, like, once you start down the road of PHP, you're kind of stuck in this, what you've chosen in the beginning. Miles also has a bad feeling about MySQL. Miles?
Well, this is one that I've had for a while. I've talked about it on the air before. It's questions about reliability with it. Not necessarily that people can keep MySQL servers up. People have. There are large sites that are running MySQL. However, I do have issue with data integrity inside. Recently, MySQL has made some inroads, made it better in that respect. But it has a non-standard syntax to it. So if many times with SQL, even though you have database-specific quirks to it, if you take an SQL query from one database, move it to another, you make some minor changes, it'll work. MySQL, it deviates far more from the ANSI standard.
But let's jump back. Wait, no, thank you, Miles, for that. Let's jump back, Russell, to your question. Did you say that the host of the website that you're creating is running Microsoft?
Yeah, it's running Windows 2000 with IIS. 5 or something.
Internet
like that.
Information Server 5.
Right. Yeah, I really don't like that idea.
Yeah, so you could do ASP, and you're not going to have to install anything else. And ASP is, Microsoft's, it's called Active Server Pages, and they're basically back-end scripting. You're going to have the least amount of setup time, but since you're a Unix guy, from the pure side, I'd push you to JSP. But do you know Java?
I know a little bit of Java, and I've heard good things about Perl CGI with their, DBI database?
Yeah.
Something or other.
Well, here's a question for you. Are you familiar with, which languages are you familiar with? Like, are you familiar with Visual Basic?
No, I'm not.
Okay. So, one possibility also would be doing ASP, but doing it in JavaScript.
Are you familiar with JavaScript?
Somewhat.
Are you familiar with JavaScript?
Somewhat.
Yeah.
Because that'll be closer to the languages you're used to. Visual Basic is very different.
Although Visual Basic is really easy to learn.
And so is JavaScript.
I would definitely, in your situation, I definitely wouldn't go with PHP. Because you're not getting thing with PHP over ASP. Except the concept that later on you could move it to a different platform. But
honestly, I'd say ASP was a cleaner API.
I'd go with ASP cleaner API as well. And database support with ASP is pretty cool. If you've got a really small database, you can use text file database if you have access to the machine. I think we've talked about this way too much, Russell, but I hope this helps you out.
Yeah, it does. My only little problem is I'm developing on Mac OS X, so
you couldn't run IIS.
Really hard for me to do ASP.
There is an ISP. There is an ASP Apache module, I think.
Mm-hmm. I heard about that. Does that work? Like,
yeah,
does that
it
take
does
standard ASP API or anything like that?
It does to some extent. Not everything is done, but most common functions are implemented. So at least for general development environments, you can have a cross-platform, like have one on Apache and one on IIS and move the ASP files over and it'll work. It's not an absolute. If you use custom COM objects, it's not going to work. But
it has, like, database support?
Yes.
Okay.
Russell, thank you very much for the call.
Thanks.
And another person from Aptos. Scott, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning, everybody. First of all, I'd like to thank you for a suggestion I heard on your show a couple months ago about free antivirus software. I downloaded AVG, and it's worked just fine for me, so thank
Great.
You for that.
Great. You're welcome.
And, yeah, it's about time for me to upgrade my five-year-old machine, and I'm committed to Windows, and I've been using NT4 all this time and pretty happy with it. And I use Photoshop sometimes with, you know, gigantic files, sometimes upwards of over 600 megs. And I'm wondering if there's any difference between the different versions of Windows available now and if they'll be as crash-free as NT4 has been for me so far. Is there much difference between...
Are you upgrading your machine? I mean,
I'm going to get a whole new machine.
Whole new machine, okay. Well, if you like Microsoft and you like NT and you want a new machine, I wouldn't get a new machine and try to install NT4 on it. I don't think it's really going to...
No, I want a new operating system because I need to use a... Yeah. A USB 2.
I would go with Microsoft XP, Windows XP Professional.
Okay.
Don't get the whole.
Are there any advantages to that as far as, like, you know, holding, dealing with lots of RAM or big files? Because I'm not.
Not really. I would say that it's more stable than 98, which would be my other option, offer. But since you're used to an NT environment and you're okay with that, there's not much reason to be in 98.
Yeah, if you're used to NT, you could also go 2000.
If you go to Windows 2000, that wouldn't that'd
Which
be
is
nice.
Very NT-like.
It's very NT-like. And
well, I don't care about, you know, learning a couple new things. Basically, I got NT at the time because the alternative was 95, and my geek friends used words like robust.
Right.
And
okay. Well, let's put it this way. You got a few choices. You can go with 2000 server. Basically, it just offers more options and it's more expensive. So basically 2000. You got Windows 98B or the most recent version 98, which is slowly not being sold as much anymore. And then you've got Windows XP Home and Windows XP Professional. You don't want the home version. So your choices are.
Could you expand on that? What's the problem with their standard XP version?
Didi?
Issues with home.
It's Didi's gut feeling at this point. Don't use XP Home.
I've heard this from Sean, too.
Yeah, I've heard
there are features missing from XP Home that I am completely forgetting right now. I will look it up.
Thank you, Didi.
Okay, because my use is, you know, large files in Photoshop, and I might be running an Access database and have the browser open at the same time.
My Intel, well, AMD box is using XP Professional, and I'm fairly happy with it. I'm also using a Macintosh OS 10. So 98 I've let go of. Miles is not. He's still using 98.
Yeah, because most of I just run games on it. But if you're running full applications, I wouldn't recommend 98.
Yeah, so our recommendation is XP. And Professional is high recommendation. If you want to hear more about that, you can email geeks at geekspeak.org, and Didi will give you a rundown on why. You can also just do XP Home Problems on Google, and I'm sure you'd find out.
Okay. And is there any advantage to going... the dual processor route. I did that with my original machine. Now I have, you know, two antiquated P2 333 processors in there. Say if the choice between, like, you know, getting a 1 3 gig microprocessor or two of them at two, is there any advantage one way or another?
Well, yeah, there's more processing power, but you're also going to run into more conflictions
well,
and
Photoshop,
problems.
Well, Photoshop, you might do fairly well with
yeah,
that processor.
I would say Photoshop you're going to do pretty well.
You just need a lot of RAM
yeah.
in that kind of environment where you're using two processors or one fast processor.
Yeah, but filters may go faster.
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah. Two processors, if you're doing a lot of Photoshop, there's nothing wrong with that. If you've got the money, I'd go for it. You're definitely going to get better performance.
Yeah, and actually, two gigahertz CPUs will probably be about the same price as one 3 gigahertz CPU.
Yeah,
so. And would it be faster? Would it actually be something you notice?
You'd see it in running two applications at the same
time.
Well,
if you had two computers side by side, you'd notice it.
Right.
Just by itself, no.
Yeah, you probably.
And compared to my old machine, everything will seem very.
Oh
bad.
My gosh!
Yeah,
you could get anything.
Yeah, it'll
be
night and day.
Amazed.
All right. Well, thank you all for the help.
Thank you, Scott, for the call. Dee Dee, I'm going to ask that we don't get into the details. Well, go ahead and give us the details of why Home is Microsoft XP Home is not such a great solution.
Well, it's kind of like any consumer line that when Microsoft has come out with for their operating system. It has the new Luna interface, an internet connection firewall, multi-user support, et cetera, but it's missing SMP support, so you can't have more than one processor. It's missing dynamic disk support, so you can't dynamically change your disk array. It's missing remote desktop. It can't participate in NT domains or Active Directory. So if you're buying a machine for work or whatever, and you have an NT domain at work, it's not going to be able to.
And of course, the multiprocessor solution right there. If Scott's choosing to go with a two-processor box, you can't use XP Home.
Right.
Good to know.
It's also missing a multi-language interface and encrypting file system.
Well, thank you, Dee Dee, for looking that up. Did you use Google to find that?
Actually, I went to a place where I knew.
Where is it?
ArsTechnica.com under the product reviews section.
Ars is a great site. Yoan, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I'm getting ready to buy a Palm-type little handheld computer.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know whether you can do any direct printing from those that do documents directly from them, or you always have to go through another computer. Is there any way to set it up?
Well, some printers have an IR port, an infrared port on them, and you can print right to infrared. You could get a really high-end Palm device that has Bluetooth, and you could print over Bluetooth to a Bluetooth-enabled printer. But the printers both need to have the interface. John, you got some more information?
It depends on what you're printing out, but they do have Palm-sized printers that actually hook onto your Palm device, and it prints out information. But think of ticker tape.
I want something that will print a regular document, and I want to stay away from the high-end. I want to stick with a pretty basic.
You're going to need Bluetooth or some form of wireless to connect to
When you say a Palm device, do you mean a Palm operating system, or do you just mean a small computer?
I mean any one of those old
Palm.
I'm using Palm generically, but the Palm-sized handheld computer.
Okay, because there's different type. I mean, if you're getting a Palm device, and you don't have another computer, and you're just going to be using that as your primary machine, formatting letters and stuff is going to be a little difficult.
I assume that's probably going to be the case, though. I just need to do, you know, really basic documents. I'm on the road, and I want to get a laptop later on. I know there's a lot of used laptops floating around.
Yeah.
But I used a Palm biological survey this last spring, and I was very happy with that. I was really amazed at how quickly you could enter letters with a pecking system.
Right. No, yeah, you definitely can. You can type stuff pretty well with it. You can also get keyboards for Palm devices. But one of the drawbacks of a Palm device is that its memory is volatile. If you lose batteries, you'll...
Excuse me, I got to put a little...
more change in the phone. You've got to put on a Palm device. You have to use some kind of backup system. And Palm comes with backup systems. Allow you to connect to a computer and basically backup and sync your data on the Palm. If you don't do that, you can lose your data on the Palm. So if you don't have a computer, your Palm's not a stable place to store your data.
The ones we were using were, I guess, with the handspring or something, and they have a little backup chip that was really great. I mean, you could just back up everything, and that chip held it in memory. But I missed some of that putting in the change, what you were saying, but which device do you think has the best possibilities for a direct connection for printing?
Unfortunately, our Palm expert's not here, Chris Dunphy, but you can, if you have access to email, you can email geeks@geekspeak.org, and we'll try to help you out on that.
Okay.
Yoan, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
We also got a couple questions through geekspeak.org, which we're not able to, well, we're not really able to get to. We had a call-in comment about IDSL. IDSL is an extension of DSL, a describer.
Digital subscriber line.
Digital subscriber line. Thank you, Dee Dee. We are running out of time on GeekSpeak, unfortunately.
If you ever have questions that we're not able to answer online, you can always email us at geeks@geekspeak.org. We'd be happy to help you out.
This morning on GeekSpeak, Dee Dee Hubbard, Miles Elam, John Tracy. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers, and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital jukeboxes, and digital video recorders. Information is at Seagate.com. You can find more information about our show at geekspeak.org, where we iCarve every version. Stay tuned now for Fine Print, but first, a little bit of news from NPR. This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. And I guess NPR is not on right now, so we will keep going for just a second. And we'll just step right into Fine Print in just one moment. One more thing I wanted to mention. Thank you. Back to NPR.
No.
Larry?
At 01 you go.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Larry. Larry Blood helping us in the studio. This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. Last week we talked with Paul McGrath from Mixed Signal Systems of Scotts Valley, talking about IC design. An archive of that show can be found at geekspeak.org/shows. Paul's a member of UMGM, who's performing this week in Santa Cruz at the Broadway Playhouse, both Friday and Saturday night at 8 p.m. Thank you all for calling in to GeekSpeak.